It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The book is considered one of humanity's greatest creations, and a lot of people would say that war is one of our worst. But according to our next guest, the two are more interconnected than we think. In his new book, he traces the role that the printed word has played in conflicts around the globe, in propaganda, as a military target, as a pastime on the front line and the home front, and much more. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you seek out books about war, either fiction or nonfiction? Have you read any historically significant books that played central roles in the wars of the past? If you've served in the military yourself, did books help relieve the stress and or the tedium? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew Pettigrew is an award-winning author and professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. His newest book is called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very pleased to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
One of the first assumptions you tackle in the book is the idea that books are inherently peaceful. Why do we usually think that? And how have books really been wrapped up so much in violence and conflict?
Well, I think all through the history of book ownership, they've been, for many people, a marker of civilization, as I think are libraries, which is why any attempt to close a public library or to cut its hours is always greeted by howls of protest, even by people who don't truthfully regularly use those libraries. So people think of print culture as a uniquely civilizing influence and don't take into consideration the fact that dictatorships are as aware of the value of books as are democracies.
You focus in a lot on the era before World War I and the books written for grown-ups and for kids, and how much they, in many ways, prepared people, got people excited even for the concept of war. Can you talk a little bit about how so many countries follow that path?
Yes, between about 1870 and the outbreak of the First World War, there weren't a lot of conflicts between frontline great powers. In Europe, at least in Western Europe, it was largely a peaceful period, and most of the conflicts were imperial conflicts between Western armies and local peoples in the areas that they had added to their empires. So in this period of relative peace, people felt pretty good about themselves in places like Germany and Britain. And if they felt less good, it was because they thought they hadn't had their fair share of the imperial cake when the rest of the world had been sliced and diced. So there was a sort of literature of glorification, if you like, of imperialism, often cunningly disguised in boys' magazines, where young heroes went out into the colonies and showed their natural leadership abilities. So it was a period which valued leadership skills, it valued courage, and it valued self-sacrifice. So this is what led so many people to rush into recruitment offices when the First World War broke out, with, as we now know, tragic consequences.
And World War One itself, when we look back and think of the literature and the poetry that came out of that, I think we might think of what came out of the end of it and the regret and the horror of war. You point out it's estimated that there was an explosion, like 50,000 poems a day, or so, I can't remember the exact number of, in most cases, pro-war poetry. There was an explosion of very positive war print at the outset of that war.
Yeah, what we find in both the First and Second World Wars is that whatever people thought before the war about the prospect of going to war, and in 1939, people were incredibly terrified of another war, not least because they feared bombing would be much more effective. Nevertheless, all of the professional groups in society, the lawyers, the judges, the police, the authors, the publishers, students, professors, they all rallied to the patriotic cause of their own nation. And in total war, everyone is vulnerable, but it also means that everybody wants to do their piece to play their part. And this comes in very many different ways. Sometimes it consists of rummaging around in your cupboards to find some books, either to give, to be sent to the troops, or to be pulped, to be recycled into the war effort. And I found in my investigations that actually more books were lost through the salvage operations, where all these books were gathered to be recycled, than actually as victims of the bombing, which is a rather extraordinary fact.
When people think of World War II and books, they might think of the book burnings, of course, in Nazi Germany. Shocked the world in many ways. It served as a symbol of the Nazi regime. You have an image of that. You also have an image from Baraboo, Wisconsin, 1918, where people are burning German language books with a large German immigrant population here in Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit about that maybe lesser known wave of book burning here in the U.S.?
Well, my apologies for singling out Baraboo, but yes, when the United States joined the conflict in 1917, there was an enormous amount of pent-up energy to be put into raising the money for the troops, for collecting books for the troops. But this also had its negative impact in the sense that German neighbors or neighbors of German heritage suddenly found themselves very coldly received. And one consequence of that, and this again comes down to trying to do something, was a clear out of German language books in the public libraries and often too in school libraries. Now, that is something which I'm afraid the American public had largely forgotten by the time of the Nazi book burning. So they reacted very, very adversely to when they heard of the Nazi book burnings. Demonstrations were held, but without reflecting too much on their own context.
Andrew Pettigrew is with us. His new book is called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andrew, you look at the book as a wide concept, hardcover books, softcover books, and pamphlets and maps. I want to give a listen here to President Franklin Roosevelt speaking in February 1942, 2 months after Pearl Harbor, looking at the Pacific theater of war.
It is warfare in terms of every continent, every island, every sea, every air lane in the world. That is the reason why I have asked you to take out and spread before you a map of the whole earth and to follow me in the references which I shall make to the world-encircling battle lines of this war.
FDR says to take out your maps, and in your introduction, I believe you mentioned that maps, atlases, globes sold out pretty much over the next week after that speech.
Well, thank you for finding that clip. It's wonderful to hear it. Yes, FDR was a tremendously empathetic speaker and judge of his electorate. And he knew that once America was at war, everybody would want to know what was going on. But here was the problem, that in many respects, America found itself woefully underprepared in terms of their knowledge of the Pacific islands and atolls where their boys would be sent to fight. And at one point, they adopted the rather desperate maneuver of asking the public to send in their holiday snaps and guidebooks in the hope that this would improve knowledge of, for instance, the Solomon Isles. And that wasn't much use. What happened was that the librarian of the Library of Congress then organized a scheme whereby this never happened again. So he gathered together the major public and university libraries, and each of them was designated a sphere of collecting, so that all the books, let's say, on India would be collected by one library, and so on and so forth, so that if they found themselves once again in an unexpected naval or land war against anywhere on the globe, they would at least have the resources with which to fight such a war. And it does bring home how important knowledge of every square mile of the world's territory is essential if you're going to be prepared for these sometimes not well-anticipated conflicts.
Andrew Pettigrew is with us. His new book is called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your opinion of wartime censorship? We've heard of a couple of examples so far. Are there books you think were justified in being taken off shelves or destroyed during wartime? Have you served in the military? How important were books for you as recreation, maybe during your deployment? We'll talk about that in just a bit. You could join in with your experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Andrew Pettigrew from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, professor of modern history there, looking at his new book. It's called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict, Conflict Shaped Reading. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you read an influential book about war, fiction or nonfiction? If you've served in the military, maybe overseas during a conflict or peacetime, was reading a part of the way you passed the time? Join in at 800-642-1234. Andrew, something I learned, one of the many things I learned in your book, just a few days after the D-Day invasion during World War II, ships brought in critical supplies, crates and crates of books for the troops to read. This is something you focus on a lot, the role that reading played for troops during wartime. Tell us a little bit of what you found.
Well, the American service editions, which were the books that were coming ashore, one of those most remarkable ventures of the war. It had become clear that the books given to these book drives weren't really the sort of things that the troops wanted to read, and they were sort of hardback books which it was difficult to fit anywhere into your gear. So instead, the Army and the Navy got together and they commissioned what was ultimately a series of 1,000 different titles, mostly of modern fiction, but some classics, some non-fiction titles. And these were published in significant editions in a paperback format, which was made to go into the pocket of their combat trousers. And then these were just given away free of charge to troops wherever they were outside the United States. And getting them to these small detachments on numerous Pacific islands was an extraordinary logistical triumph. And they were enormously popular, something like 122 million copies of these books were published.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Justin is with us in Menominee. Justin, hello.
Yes, I just was wondering if you had any insight on how anti-war kind of poetry such as that by like Siegfried Sassoon, Counterattack and Other Poems, and other, you know, remarque on sort of the German side here of World War One, how that impacted European perceptions of war.
Oh, interesting question, Justin. And that is something that you get into in the book, Andrew.
Yes, well, thank you very much for that question. It is indeed extremely interesting. What I would say is the normal pattern is that this sort of literature of reflection and regret tends to follow about a decade after the war is over. And it's then when people are sufficiently detached for it to be able to think through these consequences without seeming unpatriotic. And it's certainly the case with Siegfried Sassoon and Homark and all the other authors of the First World War pity of war school, if you like. They didn't sell particularly well at the time, it must be said, and they sort of came back into favor in the 1960s, when the general climate was much more susceptible to anti-war sentiment. But then, you know, we have to remember that the same is pretty much true of the Vietnam War, when a lot of the best writing about Vietnam came long after the conflict had failed. At the time, the American people were much more supportive of the war than we've come to think of it in retrospect.
Justin, thanks for that call. We're talking to historian Andrew Pettigrew about his new book, The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. Andrew, there's a lot of attention to books that get censored during wartime. Something that surprised me was that in the run-up to World War II, Hitler's book Mein Kampf was a bestseller in England, and for at least some of the Allied troops, it was not banned. The sense, I think, that the more you read this, the more you're going to want to stop Hitler. Could you talk about that decision a little bit?
Well, the first complete translation of Mein Kampf into English only occurred in 1938-1939. Before, there'd been a heavily sanitized version. So FDR, for one, was certainly should be a full version so people could see the full impact of what Hitler was saying. In consequence, far from being banned, Mein Kampf was put on recommended reading lists for camp libraries when army camps were set up all around Britain. With that exception, I would say that the wartime censorship is more similar in the dictatorships and the democracies than one might imagine. But it mostly was imposed on the newspapers rather than the books. A couple of books in Britain were withdrawn, not because they were pro-German, but because it was thought the plot line might cause the Germans to realize that the secret of Enigma had been broken and the Brits were listening to German transmissions. Now, that was rather paranoid, but it does show how important it was seen to be to keep the secret of Enigma as long as possible. And in fact, it was the Germans didn't really know the extent to which the British and Americans were listening to their traffic until after the war.
During wartime, you write that people do a lot of reading, whether at home or on the front. Did people seem to prefer books about war or books about anything but war to escape that reality for a while?
I think it differs a little bit. On the home front, there was interest in every aspect of the war. You know, why France fell in 1940, why the Finns had put up such a good fight against the Russians in 1939. When Russia joined the war, there was a surge of books about Russia published in Britain. So, you know, on the home front, I think there is enormous interest in what's going on, and that caused a considerable reorientation of the publishing industry to take that into account. I think troops were more interested in recreational reading and, I think, in newspapers. That was a very important part in their lives, and special newspapers for the troops became a feature of the Allied forces, with, once again, the very well-resourced troops of the United States having a particularly strong performance in terms of truce newspapers, not least Stars and Stripes, which was distributed throughout the world.
And just our last couple of minutes, Andrew, books and libraries of books, collections, were often targets in wartime. Why did we see, in some cases, bombing campaigns and other efforts to destroy books on the enemy side?
Well, in one respect, books were bound to be collateral damage. If you've got sort of unrestricted bombing warfare, because libraries have premises often in the city centres, often rather splendid buildings, they're almost certain to be attacked. But on the other hand, libraries were also important war resources. The New York Public Library, for instance, had one of the best map collections in the United States. It was bound to be used for military purposes. When the German Luftwaffe destroyed the center of Coventry, including its public library, they were destroying many people's houses. Many people lost their lives, but it also destroyed one of the great collections of technical industrial literature in the Coventry Public Library. It's not as if libraries weren't playing a role in the war.
Andrew, just in our last few minutes, do you think these issues are still relevant now in the internet age and how we think of books in conflict?
Well, you'd think that books would be less relevant. But if you study the Ukrainian war of the present day, you see so many phenomena that we associate with the Second World War. Libraries being destroyed by bombing, a flight to the West, leaving all your collections of books behind, libraries being used to teach Russian-speaking Ukrainian citizens Ukrainian when they go out, the paper being scarce and more costly, white writers being weaponized on both sides, and Ukrainians taking into central collecting points their Russian language books so that they can be pulped for reuse. Or every aspect of that is 20th century, even if the war is being fought with 21st century weapons.
Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, it's been a real pleasure.
Andrew Pettigrew is an award-winning author and professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict-Shaped Reading. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We don't always have time or inspiration to create brand new, exciting dishes every night of the week, but it doesn't take a lot of time to pull together a delicious sauce. It's Food Friday, and our guest says a creative sauce could turn even the most basic dish into something new and exciting. In her new cookbook, she's got 50 options for us to try. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a sauce that you like to make and cook with and use on pretty much everything? Is it homemade or store-bought? Do you have dishes you make that are pretty much a vehicle for an excellent sauce? Or do you have a question for our guest? Maybe you've got a thing you're kind of bored of making and you need to freshen it up with something different. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ashley Boyd is the cook, photographer, and food blogger behind Pink Owl Kitchen. She's the author of the new cookbook, Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable, Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be on.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you got into food blogging and ultimately this sauce cookbook.
Sure. So I've been cooking since I was a teenager. It's just something that I've always loved to do. I married into a really big family back in 2016, and I became like the go-to chef for all of our gatherings, anywhere from like 50 to 100 people, you know, I was cooking for sometimes. So I said, hey, why don't I try to, you know, do what I love as a career? So I started a food blog and I found a way, you know, to make it my full-time gig. And so here I am now a published cookbook author. So it's been a wild ride, but very rewarding.
Now, I love your philosophy in the book, and I feel like your introduction was kind of speaking to me, right? I'm one of these people. I've got a lot of things I like to make. It always comes out about the same. It's fine, but I get a little bored. Talk about your sauce philosophy and how to help people like me break out of those go-tos.
So, I mean, plenty of people find themselves in that same boat, right? You know, you can't think of another way to serve like grilled chicken or roasted vegetables or potatoes. But hey, sauce is the answer. When in doubt, add sauce. That's kind of my philosophy. you can make these sauces in bulk, you know, pack them in the freezer. You can keep them in little condiment bottles in the refrigerator and just have them on hand whenever you need to, like, zhuzh up, you know, a basic weeknight meal to get the kiddos to eat something or try something different. It's just, it's a handy little back pocket kitchen tool, I like to say this cookbook is.
And another thing I love is, you know, you could write a cookbook of sauces with hard to find ingredients and you got to stir for 5 hours to reduce it just right and stuff like that. Your recipes are really straightforward. All the ingredients I know I either have or they're even in a small grocery store. Was that really intentional by you? You wanted this to be really accessible for people?
It absolutely was very intentional. So this cookbook differs from some other sauce cookbooks you may have seen on the shelves because, like you said, it doesn't require any very hard to find ingredients, or you don't have to be like super skilled. There are no crazy techniques to make these sauces. It's very accessible for home cooks like you and I.
And on your blog, you specialize in Southern-inspired cooking, and there's some of that mm-hmm. in the cookbook, but you also reach beyond that. Can you talk about the scope you were trying to tackle in your 50 sauces?
Yes. So this cookbook was a way for me to kind of break out of my comfort zone. I am a Southern girl, and Southern comfort food is what my blog is based around. But when I got approached with this concept to do globally inspired sauces, I said, hey, there's a chance for me to learn, you know, new ingredients, new ways to make dishes and, you know, flavors inspired by all over the globe. So it really took me out of my comfort zone and I had to do a lot of research. So it was fun. It was a learning experience. And now, you know, I've got like this plethora of new sauces and flavors that I can use in my cooking.
And I got to ask, you said there's a big family you married into. Are they sort of your focus group when you're trying something new?
Absolutely. whenever I've got something new that I want to see, you know, how it goes over first with the family, I'll serve it to them. And if they're like, oh, yeah, this one's good. What is this? I'm like, OK, well, we'll test it again and, you know, put it out there for the masses. But, yeah, they're definitely like my little guinea pigs.
Ashley Boyd is with us on Food Friday. Her new cookbook is called Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable, Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite sauce to make, to cook with, or do you need some inspiration to make that, I don't know, baked chicken breast or that burger or that stir fry a little different this time around? You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ashley, you shared a couple recipes with us. We've got them online at WPR.org/food. Now, here's one that's coming from your Southern cooking background, the comeback sauce. This one looks like a lot of fun. Tell us about it.
Yes. So comeback sauce originated in my hometown, Jackson, Mississippi. And the name, it's a fun play on how we sometimes say see you later or a greeting like that. It's y'all come back now. So that's where the name originated. And it originated in a little restaurant in Jackson, Mississippi. And we literally, like in Mississippi and like all over the Southeast, you will find this like on restaurant menus. We literally serve it with like just about everything. And it's a creamy, like mayonnaise-based sauce. It's got a little bit of spice. The way I like to describe it to people who may have never had it is think of if remoulade, Thousand Island, ranch dressing, and barbecue sauce all had a baby, it would be comeback sauce. Yeah, it's absolutely delicious. Like I said, we put it on everything from sandwiches, French fries, fried pickles, blackened fish, fried fish, like you name it.
And the starting point, I love this because I've been doing this a lot lately with sauces. Starting points are mayonnaise and ketchup. And there might be, you know, I feel snobby. What? I don't want mayonnaise or ketchup my sauce. Mayonnaise and ketchup are awesome together. And I'm sad that it took me so long in my life to figure that out. Could you talk about using those as a base or at least a part of sauces?
Yes. So, you know, you got people that are kind of like, you know, on either side of the fence. Mayonnaise and ketchup, come on, you know, really. But I'm telling you, in the comeback sauce and in a lot of other sauces, it just does something really magical. And then you have other ingredients in this sauce. Like I use sriracha. A lot of my Mississippi friends would say, you know, that's blasphemy because they prefer chili sauce and comeback sauce and a lot of comeback sauce recipes, but I use sriracha. And then you've got Worcestershire sauce, which adds that delicious umami flavor, fresh lemon juice, whole grain mustard. You've got some fresh garlic, fresh herbs, parsley, and then you can season it up however you like. I love paprika, onion powder, and garlic powder. So combine all that with the mayonnaise and the ketchup. You've got a creamy base, and then there's a bunch of like zing, you know, in there as well. So it's a really delicious sauce.
All right. Now, where is this sauce going? What are your favorite dishes to put this on?
Everything. Like, I eat it on my scrambled eggs. Like when I say everything, I mean everything. I keep me some in the refrigerator in a squeeze bottle, but probably my favorite thing, if I had to pick one thing, would be hush puppies. I love hush puppies with comeback sauce.
And, you know, we're making maybe a big batch of this. How long can we refrigerate this kind of thing for after we mix it?
So you can keep this in the refrigerator for about a week. You probably go up to 10 days. But the great thing about it is make you a huge batch, put you some in the squeeze bottle in the refrigerator, and then freeze the rest. And then just thaw it out a couple days before. And then you can just keep doing that to cycle through that batch you've got in the freezer.
Excellent. So it freezes good. Do a lot of the sauces in the book freeze well?
All of them do. So in making this cookbook, you know, that was something that I got to find out firsthand because I had so much sauce, right? So I was freezing it and I'm like, oh, I wonder if this will be good, you know, and I thought out. And every sauce in the cookbook freezes well. So that's great.
Okay, now comeback sauce sounds like it would be a great sandwich condiment as well. I love sandwiches. What are some of the other sauces you like to put together that are great sandwich condiments?
Okay, so for sandwiches, I would say my roasted red pepper tzatziki sauce. It's so good on like wraps and sandwiches. I've also got a Southwest ranch in there that's really good on sandwiches. If you want to go the herby route, probably the basil pistachio pesto. It's really good on like a fish sandwich, chicken sandwich. There's a ton more, but those are the ones that kind of stick out in my mind.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Ashley Boyd about her new cookbook. It's called Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable, Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. Got a couple of those recipes online at WPR.org/food, including the comeback sauce we were just talking about. Now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you had a special sauce at a restaurant that keeps you going back? Have you tried to recreate it at home? How did that go? Do you have a dish you make all the time that you're getting kind of bored of? You're looking for a way to mix it up, spice it up, do something different. Ashley might have some suggestions for you. Is there a secret sauce that you use in your cooking all the time? Maybe that other people ask you the recipe for. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up our Food Friday conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're picking up our conversation with Ashley Boyd, food blogger at Pink Owl Kitchen, and we're talking about her new cookbook. It's called Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear about your favorite sauce, condiment, salad dressing, marinade, the go-to maybe for grilling season? That's coming up. Well, it's been pretty warm. Maybe it's here already. Join in now at 800-642-1234 with your favorites or your questions. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ashley, I just looked at our chat. You've inspired a lot of conversation among the Central Time producers here. Colleen says, I sometimes eat salad just so I can have green goddess dressing. Well, and there's green goddess dressing in your book. What goes into making, I've bought it in packages, never made it myself. What goes into green goddess?
So green goddess is, it's a creamy sauce with a ton of herbs. So there's a lot of flavor in it. The one in the cookbook, it's really zesty. So this one, you can use, you want a creamy base. I like Greek yogurt. You do a ton of herbs, baby spinach, parsley, dill, basil, green onions, fresh lemon juice is a must, as well as lemon zest. You can also use a different citrus if you like. Orange is really good. There's also anchovies in Green Goddess dressing. Well, in some of them, you can omit it if anchovies aren't your thing, but they really add something like really special to Green Goddess, that kind of briny flavor. And then, of course, extra virgin olive oil to kind of bring it all together. So Green Goddess, it's absolutely delicious. It's one of my favorites as well.
And do you have other favorite salad dressings?
So I like a kind of like vinegary-based salad. Mm-hmm. So if you give me something like an Italian red wine vinaigrette, any type of vinaigrette, I'm there for it.
Excellent. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Oh, not quite ready yet. We'll get to them in just a minute. Well, let's check out the other recipe you gave us, Ashley, a coconut chili crisp sauce. Crisp and sauce. That's interesting. What's going on there?
Mm-hmm. So this one is really, really fun. Coconut chili crisp, you may see it sometimes referred to as chili oil or chili sauce. So it became like super popular here in the past few years, and it's inspired by Chinese cuisine. And it is a sauce. You basically, you simmer a bunch of ingredients in oil to get them really crispy and browned. And then, so what we use in ours is chopped shallots, and then we add some star anise pods and cinnamon stick to give it some extra flavor. It just adds that little something extra you can't quite put your finger on. You're like, oh my God, it's so delicious. And then unsweetened coconut flakes, red pepper flakes, and there's a little bit of soy sauce in it, as well as a tad bit of sugar and a little bit of salt, just to bring everything together. You simmer that in the oil, and then you kind of let it sit there and crisp up. And you can put it on like just about anything. Think ice cream. Yes, ice cream. Noodles, rice, vegetables, potatoes. That's another one that we keep. We've got some in the refrigerator right now. Like, we keep it on hand. My husband, as soon as we get low, he's like, we need some more chili crisp. I'm like, okay, I got you.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Maggie is with us in Brookfield. Maggie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, years ago, my mother-in-law used to make a ham loaf, and with that ham loaf recipe came a sauce. It was a mustard sauce, and I make that mustard sauce, and it's in my refrigerator all the time, because no matter how mediocre your meatloaf is, putting that mustard sauce on makes it taste really good. So I have that in my refrigerator all the time.
What else is in there apart from mustard? Is this one of those sort of mustard, brown sugar, glazy sort of things?
Right. Mustard, egg yolks, some oil, Worcestershire sauce, onions, that sort of thing. And it's the yellow mustard that you buy in the store,
sure.
the bright yellow stuff.
Maggie, thanks a lot for sharing that. It sounds delicious. And Ashley, mustard is a frequent co-star in your recipes. It's in that comeback sauce, I think. And you're using whole grain mustard. What kind of, it's a little different, I think, than the yellow mustard Maggie's talking about. What are you looking for in the mustard you mix into sauces?
Yeah, so you can certainly substitute the yellow mustard that Maggie was just referring to if you don't have any whole grain mustard on hand. But the mustard that I love to use, it's got a little more of what's the word? I don't know. It's got a stronger flavor. My husband is like, oh, that's the strong mustard. I'm like, yeah, it's a strong mustard. But it's got, I think there's a little bit of like white wine in it, and it's got like the little seeds in it. It's just, it's got a stronger flavor. And what I like to tell people, if you can get your hands on some Creole mustard, it's even better. It's like a whole grain mustard, but it's got a little bit of spice to it. And I think there's like a little bit of like Worcestershire sauce in there, but it's really good. It's made by Zatarain's. And if you can find it like on Amazon, or if you have any markets there that may have it on hand, you've got to try it out in the remoulade. It's so good.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Ashley, we've got a whole mustard museum here in Wisconsin.
Hundreds,
I'm going to say maybe thousands. Yeah. And actually, another reason to come up here, maybe one of our producers is wondering, do you know about fried cheese curds down there? This is big in Wisconsin, like deep fried cheese curds.
Cheese curds. Okay. I have not heard of that.
Okay. So take like squeaky cheese curds, batter, deep fry them. So you got to come to Wisconsin sometime. Here, so for fried food in general, what are some of your favorite dipping sauces?
Okay. Number one's got to be the comeback sauce, which we've been talking about a lot.
Sure.
Comeback sauce, remoulade. Ranch dressing, any type of like flavored ranch. Like I love an avocado ranch, Southwest ranch, which is in the book. So yeah, any type of like creamy ranch type thing. I'm here for it.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Ashley Boyd about her new cookbook. It's called Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable, Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. We heard from Samantha, who called in on the road, says she loves ketchup and mayonnaise together. I'm right there with you, Samantha. She wants to know if there are other ways to jazz it up. Well, Samantha, if you're still listening, WPR.org/food, you can find that comeback sauce. It is heavily jazzed up, mayonnaise and ketchup. Ashley, are there other directions to take our fry sauce or mayonnaise and ketchup and do something different with them?
So there's this sauce I'm like, I don't have like a written recipe for it, but it's a mayonnaise and ketchup base. I call it like just my Cajun dipping sauce, but it's that. I add a little bit of sour cream in there as well, some seasoning, some hot sauce. I mean, you can do a lot with mayonnaise and ketchup as a base. You know, just have fun. Get in the kitchen and have fun and taste it. If it tastes disgusting, throw it out and start a new batch.
Now, are there sauces that you have found are good for kids? Maybe the picky eater type kids, or maybe picky eater grownups that gets them to try some foods they might not like without that good sauce.
So I have a 2-year-old.
So there you go.
I have a 2-year-old son. Yeah. And he is very, very picky. So I can get him to try lots of different things if I add a little bit of sauce. let's see. What's the most recent thing? There was a broccoli. The kid does not want to eat broccoli to save his life. So if I serve broccoli with the it sounds like it doesn't really go together, but he loves it. The guava barbecue sauce, which is a recipe in my cookbook. If I serve the broccoli with the guava barbecue sauce, oh, it's like the best thing in the world. Serve the broccoli by itself, not so much. But yeah, there are tons of sauces in here that could get picky eaters to eat things that they normally would not pick up and eat.
Well, I want to finish up by talking about the last section in your book, dessert sauces, which I honestly didn't expect to find in there. What kind of stuff are you putting out there for us to close our meals with a great dessert with?
So you've got some things that you may be familiar with, like you've got creme anglaise. I know that sounds fancy, but it's really not hard to make at all. You've got a salted caramel sauce in there, which is one of my favorites. And then you've got some that, you know, you may not have heard of before, like the blackberry basil coulis. That one is so good because you've got the sweet and tart blackberries, and then you've got basil, which gives it that herby flavor. And, you know, of course, some sugar and some lemon juice. That one's really good on pancakes, on ice cream, on bread pudding. Let me see. What's another one that I really love in there? Oh, the brown sugar peach sauce. That's one of my favorite things. We love bread pudding in the South, so... bread pudding is like a suggestion for almost all of the dessert sauces, but I love the brown sugar peach sauce over bread pudding. It is to die for.
I love bread pudding. I made so much of it. My kids were making fun of me like during COVID. Like that was, maybe it was my coping tool or something. I made and they hate it. They want nothing to do with bread pudding. Do your kids eat it?
Oh, wow. My son loves it. He loves bread pudding. He tears it up. It's one of his favorite desserts. So,
excellent. Well, Ashley, are there any new sauces you're kind of experimenting on with your lab subjects and your family?
I haven't tried anything recently. I'm trying to think here. I mean, I'm always mixing up some kind of sauce, to be honest with you, but I have not done like a written recipe for anything yet. We're always whipping up sauces in the kitchen. So it's like it's constant.
Ashley, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a bunch of fun. Thank you.
Ashley Boyd blogs at Pink Owl Kitchen. We talked with her on Food Friday today about her new cookbook. It's called Saucy, 50 Recipes for Drizzly, Dunkable, Go-To Sauces to Elevate Everyday Meals. Real straightforward stuff. You can find two of those recipes, try them at home, over at WPR.org/food. We got the comeback sauce. Do a lot with that. And then that coconut chili crisp sauce. Again, they're both online at WPR.org/food. And if you have a favorite sauce, still time for you to share it. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And man, oh man, if you love that ketchup mayo combination by itself or dressed up like that comeback sauce like I do, love to hear about it. Let us know what you do with it. Email ideas@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Many business leaders anticipate that artificial intelligence and other technological advancements will keep becoming bigger parts of our jobs and our workplaces. A recent survey from IBM found that executives are starting to prioritize people skills in the workplace over technical proficiency, thinking that technology is going to handle more of the duties that require technical skills. Things like flexibility, time management, teamwork, and effective communication are getting more valuable, supposedly at least, while more specific computer and software skills could become less important. It's creating a bigger emphasis on what are often called soft skills that aren't directly taught in schools all the time, but we learn along the way. Our next guest researches this type of skill development and says we need to stop thinking of soft and hard skills as separate things and blend them together instead. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Where did you learn personal and interpersonal skills like time management, working together as a team, things like that? Was it in school, on a particular job, from a role model? Should we put more emphasis on teaching them in schools, in higher education, in training at workplaces? How valuable are they to you in your workplace? If you hire people in any capacity, do you value these skills? Do you have a hard time finding them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Matthew Hora is an associate professor of adult and higher education and education policy studies at UW-Madison. He was previously the founding director of the Center for Research on College Workforce Transitions at UW-Madison. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thanks for having me.
How do we define these types of skills that we're talking about? First of all, what do we usually mean when we talk about these non-technical or interpersonal or, and you don't like the phrase, we'll get into that in a minute, the soft skills?
Yeah, so soft skills typically refer to a category of human aptitude or ability that has to do with acting and thinking and just being in the world. Like you mentioned, they commonly are referring to things like communication or teamwork or critical thinking. And some other ways they're often talked about is they're generic, so they're not linked to any specific discipline like history or chemistry, and they're decontextualized, so they're not linked to any specific workplace or national borders. These are set as opposite to hard skills, which are typically the content, so knowledge of welding, knowledge of chemistry. Sometimes they refer to manual dexterity, like can you, use a surgeon's knife? But this hard and soft skill dichotomy has been with us for a long time.
And you don't like that. You don't like that split, as I understand it. You've written about this. Tell us, there are a variety of reasons. Why don't you like this concept of soft skills, first of all?
So one of the longstanding critiques of the term soft is that it implies that these skills, let's say critical thinking, for example, it's easy to teach and learn. It's kind of mushy. The skills have often been gendered too, where they're effeminate as opposed to the hard skills that are more masculine. I buy those critiques. I think they're valid, but I don't think they're the real important critiques to consider. The bigger critique is that this binary of hard and soft really is an inaccurate way to think about how humans actually enact skills in the performance of tasks. And ironically, this is a conclusion that the people that invented the term soft skills realized back in 1972. There was a U.S. Army Behavioral Science Research and Development Unit. They were charged with coming up with a new categorization system for job tasks in the armed forces. They were supposed to do some performance evaluation and training. And so they came up with the system. Soft skills had to do with people and paper, and it had to do with tasks that were performed in these changeable and non-standardized contexts, like motivating troops in the field. Those were set in contrast to hard skills, which involved machines and that had fixed context and routines for action, like changing oil in a Jeep. But after they surveyed all these supervisors back in 1972, they realized that most tasks were people and paper oriented or a combination of those and machines. They were performed in non-standardized contexts and they had few fixed routines or rules for performance. So they decided, let's get rid of this hard and soft binary. Let's get rid of the term soft skills because it's just leading to misunderstanding. And they started to think about, we need to really teach and train people how to use their knowledge to perform tasks in uncertain settings. And they developed these wonderfully sophisticated training and teaching routines and curriculum back in the 70s that unfortunately didn't permeate the U.S. educational system because we're still talking about soft and hard skills as if they're opposites.
So did those that change in the U.S. Army work? Did it improve outcomes that they were hoping for?
That is where my knowledge of education and training in the armed forces is very limited. But it was really a joy for, academics like me. We kind of geek out when we find old reports and papers. And so I was reading the appendix of the 72 report, and they talk about this type of training they developed that involved role play and demonstration. So they wanted to teach leadership skills, for example. So they would bring in experienced military leaders who would demonstrate to junior officers how to do it. And then they would have the students practice that in different contexts and situations. That's exactly what really sophisticated skills education is looking like right now. Some of the best that I see is in medical education, where they've realized, for example, in oncology, that some clinicians are not very good at breaking bad news. And so a lot of medical education programs now include role play and demonstrations and simulations about how to break bad news to different types of people. And in those contexts, they're marrying their content knowledge with communication, empathy, and on-the-fly problem solving. So it's all fused into one kind of whole about how to enact our knowledge in the real world.
Matthew Hora is with us, Associate Professor of Adult and Higher Education and Education Policy Studies at UW-Madison, talking about how to learn job skills, distinctions between so-called hard skills, the specific tasks of a job, and so-called, though he doesn't like the phrase and many people don't now, soft skills, the communication, the teamwork, things like that, and how to train people in both and where we could do that. You could join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your experiences. How did you learn how to work as a part of a team, say, or how to communicate with others on the job? Join in at 800-642-1234. Matthew, I want to get to another concern you mentioned earlier, the idea that, okay, so maybe a college is saying, we're going to prepare students for the workforce. We're going to do some kind of program training them on communication skills. And that's going to work whatever job they go into. What I think I hear you saying is, well, hold on. Communication as part of a medical team might be one thing. From an engineer to non-engineers might be another. Customer service staff, still another thing. How important is it to connect those communication type skills to the specific context?
I think it's immensely important. One of the things that we have to realize is some of these skills, take communication, for example. They don't mean the same thing to the same people in the same context. And so recognizing that they're shaped by culture and social class and racial identity and gender is the first thing to recognize. And that impacts, I think, how we think about teaching and training them. The other is that research is pretty clear that while there's some, they call it domain general attributes of these skills, such as communication, that they're best learned and taught when it's domain specific. So that you're talking about communication in a healthcare setting or on an oil rig. Those are two actually places that we've studied. How do employers define and value communication skills in the oil and gas industry relative to healthcare? And they're really different. And so the way they're taught to students in those fields needs to recognize how they're context specific and then teach them accordingly.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Cross Plains. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what the guests would think of neurodivergent folks or folks that tend to lean that direction. I know I, with my ADHD, sometimes feel like my soft skill of time management is hindered. And at other times, it feels like it works. Similar with a bunch of other soft skills. Some I seem like I shine at. Some seem like they are intermittently good. I guess, where does he think there's – is there a place for folks with challenged brains in these kinds of skills?
John, thanks for the call. Matthew, do you have any thoughts for John?
Oh, I do, and that's a wonderful question. You're speaking with somebody who's had a few concussions and has some own unique brain functions myself. And I think this is a perfect example of how we need to not look at these skills in a kind of generic normative fashion. Again, take communication, for example. I see too many workshops that are kind of offered outside of courses about how to be a good professional communicator, right? Maintain eye contact, speak clearly, certain norms about body language. And those, again, first of all, they don't apply the same in all workplaces and in all countries, but they really don't recognize how each of us is different. And we may have different abilities and norms for communicating, and that in most cases, they're okay. They're acceptable. They should be considered normal for that person. And this is also about kind of, you know, the norms that we have and expectations we have for these skills from the employer side needs to be equally flexible, needs to recognize that, okay, this person may be coming from this national background where they don't maintain eye contact. That's not a culturally acceptable thing to do. And they need to recognize that that may be okay. Now, in some cases, it may not be. There may be meetings or, you know, other situations where eye contact is essential. And so you could teach that person, but just recognizing that we're all not conforming to the same normative stereotypes is really important.
John, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to UW-Madison education professor Matthew Hora about how we teach and learn what are sometimes called soft skills, time management, managing relationships in the workplace, working on teams. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How, when, where did you learn those kind of things? Do you think there are better ways to teach them? Is it the responsibility of employers to bring people on board and train them in these skills, or the education system? If so, where? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Matthew Hora, Associate Professor of Adult and Higher Education and Education Policy Studies at UW-Madison. He's with us today to talk about how we develop non-technical skills for the workplace, things like communication, organization, teamwork, often referred to as soft skills. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions you have about how we teach and learn those skills? Where did you learn them for yourself if you employ people? Do you have trouble finding people with those skills? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Matthew, I want to focus on higher education here. Say a college wants to graduate students with these skills. Some students go to college knowing, hey, I'm going to go into a healthcare field, or I'm going to go into engineering, or what have you. Many don't. They're going to get the degree and then figure out the career afterwards. Since they don't have that workplace context in mind, are there meaningful ways to help develop those skills for those students?
Yes, and there's, I think, a couple of things to think about. One is that many people will not only change jobs throughout their lives or careers, but they go into fields outside of college in occupations that don't align with their major. For example, in some of the field work we've done in Wisconsin, we interviewed a number of employees who had arts and humanities backgrounds working in advanced manufacturing. And one of the reasons that they were hired was because of their flexible thinking and creative reasoning. This is what their supervisors told us. And I think that's an example where in some disciplines, teaching reasoning, creativity, critical thinking is kind of baked into the discipline, art history or philosophy, for example. And if those are taught well, which they can be taught well and they can be taught less well, but if they're taught well, that should be a habit of mind or a way of thinking that the student can take into a whole bunch of different careers and occupations throughout their lives.
Do we know how to teach those things well, consistently?
Yes, I will say we do. There's a lot of great educators out there. You know, we've studied a lot of these things, how to teach teamwork or group work, for example. It's a really rich and robust literature about how to do it across the disciplines. There's entire fields of oral communication education. And so we know how to do these things. One of the problems is that most higher education faculty are not taught how to teach at all, much less how to teach these skills. And so oftentimes I think we assume that these skills are acquired by students by osmosis just because they go to college or sit in our classrooms, but that's not the case. We have to take a far more deliberate approach to cultivating these competencies within our fields.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us now in Green Bay. Pat, hi, what did you want to bring up?
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my phone call. I was telling the person that answered the phone, these skills aren't something that a teacher needs to teach. These are skills that we're taught as we're growing up from our parents and our aunts and uncles, our family. We're taught how to communicate. We're taught how to, you know, work with other people. I just find it so hard to believe that this is something a teacher should be teaching. No, this is common sense, everyday stuff.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. Matthew, do we need schools at whatever level, higher education or primary, to be doing this stuff?
Oh, I really enjoy that question, Pat. Thank you. In our research in Wisconsin, the top skill that we heard employers say they wanted to see was work ethic, right? And so this is a classic skill, or some people consider it a personality trait, that most people would agree formal education should not be teaching. That's something that's a responsibility of the family, the religious community, and so forth. For myself, I learned work ethic as a 4-H kid, raising sheep for 5 years. And so there's things that we acquire, like you say, through our childhood, through our families, and so forth. And a lot of people view that as the responsible party for developing these skills. I will say, though, that at a certain point, there are more highly developed or professional modes of, say, problem solving, troubleshooting, critical thinking that you could only get in a formal education setting. Now, it doesn't need to be a college degree. It could be an apprenticeship. But there are some more advanced ways of enacting some of these competencies. Again, technical writing is something that we'll learn in grade school. But if you want to be a professional writer, you most likely are going to need some more advanced training. So it's a combination of socialization and enculturation, and then some more formal training on top of that.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. Barry joins us now in Coon Valley. Barry, hello.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call. I think what the professor is talking about is an absolute essential component of a successful culture, society, workforce, et cetera. And I had 35 employees at one time, and obviously I know how important the social skills, confidence, collaboration, et cetera, are. But at the same time, we are hearing consistently that we have significant issues in K-12 school districts with social emotional skills, behavior issues, et cetera. And I would just like to introduce the concept to whoever's listening out there that if we're going to have healthy people that the professor alludes to that can learn the higher level skills, we need to put two adults in every classroom from kindergarten through fourth grade. And that's about all I have to say.
Barry, thanks a lot for the call. Matthew, Barry wants us to start a lot earlier than, say, college.
There's a lot of research showing that these skills, if developed in pre-K, kindergarten, they last a lifetime, and they have impacts not just on increased wages, but things like you know, not engaging in criminal activity, health outcomes, and so forth. And so I think the earlier we can start, the better. At the same time, though, that does raise questions about the relative role of the family, the culture, the community, and formal education. The one thing I'd like to point out, though, is especially paying attention to the mental health of young children who went through the pandemic and in many cases are struggling, and we're going to see the effects of that for many years. That has to be part of the conversation of these skills, because communication, teamwork, all these things are deeply implicated in how we feel about ourselves and our state of well-being.
Thanks for that call. Matthew, just in our last minute or so, you mentioned your 4-H background as being really valuable in developing these skills. Just take a minute to tell us how that or maybe comparable programs could help not just you, but other people.
Well, if I was the emperor of the world, I would have every kid be in 4-H because I love it. One of the things I will say that in our interviews in Wisconsin with employers is we heard over and over again, not just the work ethic, but that they would hire on the spot somebody that grew up on a dairy farm. And when we pushed on that, we got, yeah, they're hard workers. They work overtime for free, things like that. But the most important thing was the ability to problem solve in really unpredictable situations. And so I think that there's things about, you know, agriculture and working with your hands and dealing with uncertain situations, it's really important. That could be translated into formal education through experiential education, whether it's internships, apprenticeships, hands-on learning projects. There's ways to do it, and we know how to do it.
Matthew, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
That's Matthew Hora, Associate Professor of Adult and Higher Education and Education Policy Studies at UW-Madison. He was with us today to explore how we teach and learn the non-technical skills of workplaces like teamwork, time management, and problem solving and critical thinking. Still time for you to weigh in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences, where you learn these things. If you're an employer, what you're looking for in employees when it comes to those kind of skills, you can email ideas@wpr.org.